I mean, I'm English. I'll kind of, you know, put my cards on the table. One of the peculiarities to me of American politics is the way everybody agrees on that. There's actually no disagreement about these sort of ideas, but they always remain at a kind of, or they often remain at a kind of abstract level, and the agreement is at a rather abstract level. And you know, the devil is in the details, and what Americans have always disagreed about is what those things actually mean when you try to implement them in terms of public policy. You know, what does freedom mean? And you know, how does it mean different things to different people? And you know, what does liberty mean? What does democracy mean? I mean, I would say, you know, one thing I would say is that, because I've just sort of finished doing this, or finishing up this course on the early republic, but, you know, the founders certainly didn't believe in a kind of an unalloyed democracy. That was something that they were more open about. They talked about freedom, they talked about liberty, but they didn't talk about democracy. And they often, when they did, they talked about it in pejorative terms. You know, they saw democracy actually as problematic, and often as a threat, being, you know, what Republicans today would call mob rule. And you know, so there was much more skepticism about that, I think, during the founding period.
Saying is, there was a difference between the ideas of freedom and democracy and the kind of government that could happen under.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a difference. I think, although they saw ideas of freedom and democracy as not linked in the way that we would link them with democratic political representation. You know,
well,
political
connection happen.
Well, I think gradually over time. I mean, I think that's something that we've had to fight for. You know, since the revolution itself, the gradual expansion of American systems of political representation to reflect, in some ways, the ideals of the early of the founding period.
Wait a minute.
Know,
so you're saying that democracy, how democracy, or that even there was a democracy, evolved as people tried to figure out how to implement the ideals of freedom?
Well, and fought to do so. I mean, I think the original ideas about freedom and liberty were things that were very much assumed to apply to what were seen as sort of independent Republican citizens who were largely male and white, and in the first instance, sort of property holders. And then gradually, you know, the link between property and political rights gets sort of sheared away. And then, you know, over the course of the 19th century and by the early 20th century, the link between gender and political representation shifts. You know, so women get the vote. And then over the course of the 20th century, taking a much longer time, you know, these links between race and citizenship get sort of transformed, you know, finally by the civil rights movement, so that our systems of political representation reflected much more the ideals of the founding period. But it takes a long, long time. You know, I mean, I would argue we've only been a democracy since, I say this to my students, since 1965, really, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the mid-60s. Before that, you know, we can kind of quarrel about what democracy means, but if it means people voting, which I think is a kind of, you know, basic sort of benchmark, then you know, everybody wasn't voting until within my lifetime. So I think democracy is a relatively recent thing. These sort of founding ideals about freedom, liberty, to some extent equality, go back to the 18th century and the founding period. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Help me.
Yeah.
So freedom, I mean, the ability to vote is mm-hmm. you think, intimately connected with those original ideals?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I think the ability to vote is definitely, you know, one of the things that makes sort of freedom and equality, the promise, if you like, of the kind of declaration, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men were created equal. I think the ability to participate in the democracy, to be a citizen and to be a political citizen, is foundational. You know, I mean, it's not perhaps the end of every, you know, the kind of ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to realize a society, I think, where we have real equality and real justice, and voting doesn't necessarily inevitably lead to that, but I think it's a kind of, you know, without which nothing, you know, people at least have to be able to vote and participate in the democracy, and that takes a long time to happen, you know.
How do new voting restrictions or attempts to limit voting make sense then?
I don't think they make any sense at all. I see the attempts to use ID laws and other forms of voting restriction, this tinkering with things like, you know, addresses in the North Dakota election, I think it is, for Native Americans. The games that they're playing in places like Georgia with absentee ballots and so on. All those seem to me the legacy of a past history of racial, ethnic suppression. I think they're very much the dark legacy of a democracy that for a long time existed more in theory than in practice for many, many, many people who lived in the United States, particularly obviously African Americans, but also immigrants. You know, in the late 19th century, all this tomfoolery around voting restriction developed to restrict the voting of immigrant communities in American cities who are seen as a threat to the political establishment and a threat to the sort of existing basis of power in American cities. So I think there's a very troubling and troubled history around enfranchisement and allowing people to vote in the U.S., which we really need as a society to address. I mean, in some ways, I would argue there are so many issues before us, but you know, one of the principal ones, I think, is to ensure very simple things like everybody participates in the political process or is able to if they choose to, on relatively easy terms, and we begin to move towards a system of sort of one person, one vote, which I think most Americans imagine we've already realized. But if you look at the political system, it's very much it very much distorts the way in which the popular will is expressed through the mechanism of voting, you know, from things like the Senate, which I was just looking this morning. You know, the population of North and South Dakota is 1.5 million, and they have four senators. California, which has a population of millions, has two. So if you look at our institutions, we're a long way from being a society within which everybody has equal influence and power as a voter. Actually, some voters have much more influence and power than others, even if they're able to participate in the political system. And of course, many people, millions of people who, of course, have been convicted of things like felonies are not allowed to participate at all, which is completely wrong, I think. We restrict the voting pool, and we make it difficult for people to vote when it should be something that you possess almost by default, in my view, that you would have to sort of rid yourself of. In a kind of active way, not something that you should have difficulty acquiring. I think the right to vote in that sense is really fundamental. And there's a reason why it was at the basis of things like the civil rights movement.
Why do so few, I mean, well, why don't more people vote?
I don't know. I mean, I find it puzzling. I always tell my classes, you know, when I first came to the States about 30 years ago, I couldn't understand why Americans didn't vote. As somebody from a society where, you know, usually 70 to 80% of people participate in elections, I didn't really understand at all why Americans didn't vote. I have to admit, I think I do more now. Oh. I mean, I think there's a sense of cynicism about the political system, obviously.
Why should we have that any more than British people?
Well, for some of the reasons that I think I've sort of touched on, that I think, you know, it's tricky to sort of do that comparative history, but I think a couple of things. One, the electoral system is much simpler in the UK. It's just more straightforward. Qualifying to vote, for example, is much easier, and the actual process of voting, it's very simple. I remember the first time I voted in England, I went to a polling station, and literally I was given a black crayon and put an X on a piece of white paper, and folded it up and put it in a ballot box. And, you know, this was in the 1980s, so it wasn't like that was eons ago.
Well, not as though it's hard in America, you know.
Well, I think it's more tricky to get registered.
Oh, really?
That's definitely the case. Mm. It's also just the process is more tricky, you know. I mean, there are more things on the ballots. The ballots are more confusing. They're not so straightforward. There are more candidates at any particular time. So there are things like that. But I think the deeper issue is sort of Americans' sense of engagement with the political system and their sense of investment and ownership in it. And I think a lot of us feel disaffiliated, disenfranchised. We don't really understand the political debates. We're not clear about differences between candidates. And some of that is, I think, the outcome of a political system which has not served people's interests particularly well and has not been particularly responsive to the aspirations and needs of ordinary voters.
Is there a lack of understanding that, I mean, just to stay in place?
Yeah.
Is this required? Just to run in place, just to have whatever unsatisfactory services we currently do requires something, no?
Yes, yeah. You know, and I think, you know, in many ways, Americans don't get a lot from their government. You know, if you think about, you know, again, my own experience sort of informs this. You know, you pay taxes in a place like England or Germany, you at least get health care and sort of public education that is really pretty good. And I think a lot of Americans feel they don't get much in return, and there's some reality to that.
A lot of us don't want to pay for that. I mean, we're deliberately choosing not to pay for services.
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, that's the kind of chicken and egg thing, isn't it? You know, it's hard to know whether people would be willing to pay, not more, they wouldn't need to pay more, but to divert their payments to sort of public purposes, you know, in order to have, say, you know, free of a healthcare system, or whether, you know, whether they'd be willing to support it. You know, if it doesn't exist, you don't want to fund it, you know, but if it existed, perhaps people would. And I think actually a lot of the resistance to healthcare is fueled by that sense that once you give this to people, it's a bit like Social Security. They won't ever want to give it up, and certainly conservatives in places like Europe have found it's the National Health Service in England is the kind of like Social Security here. It's the third rail. You know, you absolutely can't say you're going to abolish the NHS. There are all kinds of ways that you could sort of chip away at it, but you couldn't openly say that you wanted to create a privatized healthcare system. You would be dead in the water politically if you did that. And I think Republicans and opponents of things like health care for all know that. They know that once that right is granted or once that benefit is given, then it will be impossible to claw it back, that people will see that, you know, this is something that makes sense. And then I think Americans would have a more positive relationship to their government as well. And at the moment they don't get those kind of benefits. I mean, in many places they don't get good public education, and they're paying more and more for college, even at state schools, you know, and so on. So I kind of, you know, there is a sense of sort of skepticism and cynicism, I think, about what government provides and the political system and the way the political system operates, that is much more profound here than it is in, for example, Western Europe. But some of it is the fault of the political system that doesn't, you know, here's a good example, Noe. I mean, you know, we're having local elections at the moment, and every day I'm getting leaflets through the door, you know, to vote for Ozawa, or, you know, Tommy Waters, where I live. None of them have a party affiliation on them at all. You know, I can figure out, I've got a, you know, PhD in history, I can just about figure out what, and I can get online and, you know, discover, broadly speaking, what their sort of party affiliation is, but they don't tell me, you know. And this is to somebody from a Western European political tradition, this is bizarre. The idea that you would select a candidate for public office without knowing what his party or her party commitments were and their affiliations were seems bizarre, to tell you the truth. And yet that's how local political candidates identify, or rather don't identify. You know, and it's part of a deeper hostility to the idea of party and partisanship and identifying with a political party that actually goes all the way back to the founding. That's one of the ideas that the founders had, that, you know, when they created the Constitution, they wanted to create a constitution that a government that was a government of disinterested men, not a government that was fueled by partisanship. And they were very, very hostile to the idea of partisanship and political parties, which in no way prevented them behaving as partisans or creating political parties, which they did do. But I think Americans, again, have this very skeptical relationship to the idea of party identity and belonging to a political party. It's not as much a part of their character. And this is particularly true when you talk to young people, I think. They tend to want to define themselves as independent, as separate from the party system. They don't really relate to it at all. And, you know, so, you know, that and again,
there's some kind of future there?
Well, no, I mean, I'm not sure what does independence mean. I mean, this is the kind of the American word, isn't it? If you like, you know, going all the way back again to the founding. You know, I mean, independence was the key American word in the 18th century. The War of Independence, you know, the independence of the Republican citizen. All these things are central to the political culture, and so it's not surprising to me that sort of young and even an older Americans as well see this as a central value, you know, to be independent. But really, it's a politically empty position. It's, what is it?
Well,
you know?
I mean, so is being a Democrat or a Republican in this town at times.
that I wouldn't disagree with, and I think, you know, this gets back to the, it's not just coming out of the culture of ordinary Americans, it's also the way in which the political system sort of has shaped those identities. For, you know, again, just, you know, because it's always about comparison, you know, I mean, I grew up as a Labour Party supporter in England. You know, that's a very important part of somebody's identity, you know, and people are not, you know, people are not equivocal or ambivalent about identifying with political parties. And people here are, and it's partly because the political parties have often not meant much either. I mean, you know, there are There have been Democrats who are segregationists, and Democrats who fought for labor rights and racial equality, right? Being a Democrat hasn't historically meant all that much, except at particular times in particular places. And as you say, being a Democrat in Hawaii, what does that mean? Everybody's a Democrat, because it's the only way to sort of gain any traction in the political system. But I don't think, you know, in a sense, that's the problem, you know, that these political parties don't have any political definition. They're just marketing organizations. They're just campaigning organizations. There's no party platform. There's no party policy. You know, there's nothing really there. You know, there's no there for, mm-hmm. for people to identify with. And that to me is a significant problem. Although, oddly enough, and then I'll shut up for a second. You know, I actually think if I have sort of hope about this, it is that American politics is becoming more idea-driven. And it is becoming more ideological, if you like. And oddly enough, this is one of the things that Americans are disturbed about right now, you know, that we're becoming divided, that there are these ideological differences, that we can't reach any consensus, that, you know, the old bipartisanship of the past is slipping away. But actually, I'm not sure that's a bad thing in itself. What's bad is that people lose faith in the political system. I mean, we should be able to have ideological differences and then kind of come together to implement public policy and to accept elections and things like that. What does disturb me is the sort of sense that, you know, and I think this is growing, particularly on the right, but I think it's there on the left too, that if the political system doesn't deliver what I want, then somehow it doesn't work. Right. So, you know, at that point, you reach, you know, what I would call a sort of legitimacy crisis. Basically, people will only buy into the political system when it provides what they believe in and what they desire. And, you know, that is one step from disintegration, in my view. I mean, because as soon as the political system doesn't provide what you believe in or you want, then you opt out of it. You know, then it's illegitimate. And I think you hear this language on the right particularly powerfully at the moment. You know, it's sort of growing, that sense that, you know, what worries me, you know, in a sense now is Trump winning worries me, but Trump losing might be even more troubling.
Awesome.
You know, because I think there are a lot of people out there on the right now who really think that the political system is fundamentally corrupt. The media is corrupt. The political system doesn't work. And the only reason that they continue to accept it is it's produced Trump himself, and it's produced sort of Republican majorities. The moment that it begins not to do that, we'll see. You know, if it produces suddenly Democratic majorities, if Trump is sort of not reelected in 2020. What will be the reaction of the people that support him? You know, I think most of them will go on living their lives and, you know, playing golf and, you know, going to school and, you know, et cetera, you know, just living ordinary lives. But some of them may react more in more violent terms. And if that happened, I think, you know, you're reaching a point where, and then I think this is what people are beginning to talk about, where the system itself, a democratic political system, a system that operates through a political process, becomes more and more tenuous. It holds the allegiance of Americans less and less. And you know, that's what worries me about the cynicism, about the sense. You know, in Germany in the 1920s, you know, before the rise of fascism, you know, one of the most common kind of political discourses was a sort of contempt for politics. You know, they talked about the German parliament, the Reichstag, as a talking shop. You know, that was an insult that was directed at this sort of do-nothing political system. And Germans themselves developed an enormous contempt for their political system. And I think that's the sort of basis for then thinking about replacements to that, you know, thinking about alternatives to that. So I see the cynicism as the disaffiliation, the desire to find oneself apart from the political system as potentially very problematic and dangerous even. I think there are real potential problems there if people cease to kind of agree or buy into the legitimacy of the political process. Does that make sense? I'm not trying to be too sort of bleak about it, but I think we're at a real crossroads right now where people really have to decide about the direction of American democracy. And you know, this is an old debate too. I have to say there's a really great book by a historian who taught me, a guy called Gary Gerstle, and he talks about two traditions in American democracy of sort of what he calls civic nationalism and sort of racial nationalism. And you know, and I think this is a battle that's gone on before, you know, rumbled away through the 19th and into the 20th century. And I think we sort of thought it was over. I think we thought that civic nationalism really had won, you know, that America was defined as John McCain would want to define it, as its ideals. You know, we all subscribe to, you know, the ideals of the founders of freedom and democracy and liberty and so on. But there's always been this kind of racial nationalism too, which wants to define it in terms of ethnicity and not, you know, blood and soil in a kind of American sense, you know, but in terms of nativism, of a kind of primal belonging, you know, we were here first, we've been here before you, and so on. And that's always been an enormously important part of American society, and I think we all thought it had disappeared, more or less, or been defeated by the civil rights movement, by the prosperity of the post-war period, and so on. But I think what Trump has sort of shown is that it didn't, that it's still there, even if it's 35% of the population, and maybe not even all of them, you know. But that sort of movement, that feeling, that cultural and ethnic insularity, the importance of sort of white identity, all those things continue to be important in American politics, and in fact appear to be becoming more important again. So that battle between sort of civic nationalism and racial nationalism, I think, has been joined, and I think that's what's going on in this midterm. So we'll see. I mean, I'm as intrigued to find out what happens as anybody. You know, I think it's really a really, really critical election.
But you think that there are ways that we can fight out whatever ideological differences we may have without necessarily attacking the structure or the way the government works? Or will it all, is it all just all tangled together?
Oh, no, I think so. Although I think we need to think deeply about the way our government works. I think, you know, if we're to move forward, you know, one of the things I say to my students is, oh, you know, the founders created what they thought was a blueprint, really, you know, something that needed to be filled in. You know, Jefferson didn't even believe in the idea of a permanent constitution. He thought it should be basically torn up and rewritten every generation, and that, you know, what Jefferson said was the earth belongs to the living, you know, not to the dead, and that the living should decide how they want to structure and order their society. And you know, so I think the founders, Jefferson was particularly radical, but the founders, they wanted to create a blueprint that we would sort of fill in as the republic evolved and changed. I think they would have been horrified by the notion that the Constitution was like the tablets of Moses, you know, that were chiseled in stone forever, and that, you know, jurists would seriously spend their time trying to figure out what the original public intent of the people who framed the Constitution you know, now going on for 250 years ago, fought. I mean, I think they'd have thought that that was ludicrous. So I think we need to think about the way in which we organize our political society and elect people and, you know, continue to reform it in ways that make it more just, more democratic, more representative, and that recognize individual rights more sensitively than they do. And, you know, that's something that's always been part of the American project, I think. And people have fought for those things, but they've often really had to fight for them. And I don't think that that fight, you know, again, I think perhaps we thought that fight was over, and I don't think it is. I think it's a continuing one to sort of realize the promise of American ideals and to embody those in our institutions and our political practices.